Ral hesitantly suggested an enemy so crazed with hatred that he'd set out to obliterate all trace of the ancients from the earth. We could all accept this. Well, fair enough, and Sally spoke for all of us. But what happened to thousands of tons of massive masonry? They scattered it out across the plain, Ral hazarded. A Herculean task, and besides, the plain was a lake in those days. To get rid of it, they would have scattered it along the area between the cliff and the lake. And there's no sign of it. Apologetically, Peter Wilcox reminded us of the account in Credo Mutua's book, In Daba, My Children, of how an ancient city was carried by its people, block by block, out of the west, and how the city was rebuilt at Zimbabwe. This is red sandstone, Sally cut in brusquely. Zimbabwe is granite, quarried from the rock on which it stands. Zimbabwe is 275 miles east of here. The labor involved is unthinkable. I will accept that the building skills and techniques were transported, but not the material itself. There were no more ideas forthcoming, and we could turn from theories to facts. At the end of 6 weeks, Lauren Stuyvesant visited us for the first time. All digging and other work was suspended, as for 2 days we held a seminar, with myself as chairman, in which we presented Lauren with all our accomplishments and conclusions to date. These were very impressive. To begin with, the list of artifacts, pottery sherds, and other relics filled 127 typewritten foolscap pages. Peter and Heather were responsible for most of these, and they opened the seminar. So far, all excavation without the enclosure has been confined to the area north of it, and lying within 1,000 feet of the outer perimeter. In the main, it seems to have been a complex of small rooms and buildings, built from adobe clay and roofed with poles and thatch. Peter described the area in detail, giving the average size of the rooms and the exact position of each object discovered. Lauren started thrashing around in his chair and fiddling with his cigar. Peter is meticulous, almost old-maidish in his approach to his work. And finally, he reached his conclusions. It seems, therefore, that this area was an extensive bazaar and market. And he led us through into the warehouse to examine the finds from this area. There were fragments of badly rusted iron, a bronze comb, the handle of a knife fashioned in the shape of a woman's body, 14 rosettes of bronze that we guessed had embossed a leather shield, 25 pounds worth weight of bronze discs, and stars and sun objects which were clearly ornaments. 16 shaped and beaten bronze plates that we hoped might comprise part of a suit of body armor, a magnificent bronze dish, 24 inches in diameter, chased with a sun image and set around with an intricate border pattern, and another 40 pounds weight of bronze scraps and fragments so badly battered and damaged as to be unidentifiable. These are all the bronze objects so far recovered, Peter told Lauren. The workmanship is crude, but not recognizably Bantu in conception and execution. It could relate more closely to what we know of Phoenician craftsmanship. Unlike the Romans and Greeks, they placed little value on the arts. Their artifacts, like their buildings, were massive and roughly executed. One other fact that emerges is the veneration of the sun. It was clearly a generally polytheistic community, but one in which sun worship predominated. In this settlement, it appears that Baal, the Phoenician male deity, was personified by the sun. I thought Peter was verging on the mistake of special pleading, but I let him continue without interruption. After discussing each item separately, Peter led us to the next row of tables that carried all the glass and pottery. 125 pounds weight of glass beads. The colors are predominantly blue and red. Phoenician colors, with greens and whites and yellows, are recovered only in levels 1 and 2. in other words, later than AD 50, which coincides approximately with the final phase of absorption of Phoenician civilization by the Romans in the Mediterranean area and its gradual disappearance. I interrupted. The Romans were so thorough in their absorption of Phoenicia and all her works that we know very little of them. My attention wandered to Sally. She was in a sparkling mood, a complete change from the previous 6 weeks when she'd been moody and withdrawn. She'd washed her hair, and it was shiny and springing with soft lights. Her skin also shone with golden hues where the sun had touched it, and she had coloured her lips and dramatised her eyes. Her beauty squeezed my heart. I forced my mind back to the row of tables. "A case in point is this recovery of pottery," Peter was saying. He indicated the huge display of fragments, portions, and a very few complete pieces. On all of this, with one exception, there is not a single inscription. This is the exception. He picked up a shard, which was set out in a place of honour, and passed it to Lurin. Although we had all gloated over it before, we crowded around Lurin as he examined it. There was a symbol cut into the baked clay. A chip from the lip of a cup or vase. The symbol could conceivably be a Punic tea. Lurin burst in impulsively, turning to me and laying a hand on my shoulder. "Conclusive, Ben. They must accept that, surely." "By no means, Lo," I shook my head regretfully. "They will cry, imported. The old trick of discrediting anything you can't explain, or which doesn't support your theories, by saying that it was brought in during the course of trade." "Looks as though you can't win, Ben," Lurin sympathized, and I grinned. "Well, at least we haven't uncovered any 14th century Nanking pottery, or a chamber pot with Queen Victoria's portrait on it." Laughing, we moved on to the next display of copper and copperware. There were bangles and brooches, green encrusted and eaten away, bales of copper wire, and significantly, ingots cast into the shape of the St. Andrew's cross, each weighing 12 pounds. "Those aren't something new," Lurin remarked. "No," I agreed. "They turn up all over Central and Southern Africa, and yet the shape is exactly that of the ingots, taken from the tin mines of Cornwall by the Phoenicians, or the copper ingots from the ancient mines on Cyprus." "Still not conclusive?" Lurin looked at me and I shook my head, leading him on to see the ironwork we'd recovered. All of it was so badly rusted and damaged that the original shape was a matter of conjecture and guesswork. There were hundreds of arrowheads, mostly associated with levels 1 and 2, spearheads, sword blades, axe heads, and knives. "Judging by the quantities of weapons, or what we take to be weapons, the ancients were a warlike people. Alternatively, they were a people fearful of attack and well armed against it," I suggested, and there was the general murmur of agreement. From the iron section, we went on to a display of my photographs, showing each stage of the excavation, views of the lower city, the temple, the Acropolis, and the cavern. "Pretty good, Ben," Lurin admitted. "Is that all you have for me?" "The best comes last." I couldn't help a little showmanship in my presentation, and I had screened off the end of the warehouse. I led him beyond the first screen, with all my team hovering anxiously to judge his reaction. It was gratifying. "Good Lord!" Lurin stopped short and stared at the phallic columns with their ornamental tops. "Zimbabwe birds!" There were three of them. Although incomplete, they stood about 5 foot high and were 30 inches in circumference. Only one of them was relatively undamaged, the other two had been mutilated so as to be hardly recognizable. The carving on top of each pillar had obviously originally depicted a vulture in bird shape with heavy beak, hunched shoulders, and predatory claws. They were similar in design and execution to those recovered from Zimbabwe by Hall, MacIver, and others. Not Zimbabwe birds, I corrected Lorin. No, Sally affirmed. These are the ones from which the Zimbabwe birds were copied. Where did you find them? Lorin asked, as he moved in for a closer scrutiny of the green soapstone figures. In the temple, I smiled at Ral and Leslie, who looked suitably modest, within the inner enclosure. They are probably religious objects. You see the sun symbols round the collar of the column. Clearly, they're associated with the worship of Baal as the sun god. We have named them the sunbirds, Sally explained, as Ben felt a name like the birds of Ophir was a bit too pretentious. Why have they been damaged like this? Lorin indicated where deliberate blows had shattered the brittle green stone. That's anybody's guess. I shrugged away the question. But we know that they'd been toppled and were lying without design or direction in the lair of ash at level one. That's very interesting, Ben. Lorin's eyes were drawn to the final screen at the end of the warehouse. Now, come on. You secretive old bastard. What have you got behind there? What the whole city and colonization was based on, I opened the screen, gold. There is something about that beautiful buttery metal that holds the imagination captive. A hush came over the party as we stared at it. The objects had been carefully cleaned, and the surfaces shone with the special soft radiance which is unmistakably gold. Coldly to itemize the collection detracts in some way from its excitement and mystery. The gross weight of the pieces was 683 fine ounces. There were 15 rods of native gold as thick and as long as a man's finger. There were 48 pieces of crudely wrought jewelry, pins, brooches, and combs. There was a statuette of a female figure 4.5 inches tall. Astarte, Tanith, Sally whispered as she stroked it, goddess of the moon and the earth. In addition, there were a handful of gold beads, with the string long ago disintegrated, dozens of sun disks, and many chips, tacks, and flakes, and buttons, of no definite shape or discernible purpose. And then I said, there is this, picking up the heavy chalice of solid gold. It had been crushed and flattened, but the base was undamaged. Look, I said, pointing to the design worked into it with uncommon delicacy of line. Ankh, the Egyptian sign of eternal life? Lorin looked to me for confirmation, and I nodded. For the Christians and heathens amongst you, we know that the pharaohs, on occasions, used the Phoenicians to supply treasure for their empire. Was this, and I turned the chalice in my hands, a gift from a pharaoh to the king of Ophir. And, do you remember the cup? In the right hand of the white lady of the Brandberg, Sally asked. It was enough to keep us arguing and locked in discussion into the early hours. And the next day, Sally, helped by Heather Wilcox, presented her drawings and paintings from the cavern. When she showed the tracing of the White King, that frown of concentration again creased Lorin's brow, and he stood up and went to examine it more closely. We waited for a long time in silence before he looked up at Sally. I'd like you to make a copy of this for my own personal collection. Would you mind? With the greatest of pleasure, Sally smiled happily at him. The mood of sparkle and smile was still strong upon her, and she was enjoying the sensation that the display of her work was causing. Sally, like most beautiful women, is not completely averse to standing in the limelight. She knew her work was damned good, and she liked the plaudits. Now, I haven't been able to decide what these are. Sally smiled as she hung a new sheet on the common room board. Those are 17 symbols similar to this which I have so far isolated. Heather calls them the walking cucumbers, or the double walking cucumbers. Have you any ideas? Tadpoles? Raoul tried. Centipedes? Leslie was a bit more feasible. But that was the end of our imagination, and we were silent. No more offers? Sally asked. I thought that with the formidable collection of academic qualification and worldly wisdom, we could do better here. A bireme, Lauren said softly, and a trireme. By Jove, and I saw it immediately. You're right. Quinquereme of Nineveh, from distant offer, Peter quoted joyously. The shape of a ship's hull and the banks of oars, I enlarged upon it. Of course. If we're right, then vessels like that must have plied regularly across the lakes. We could accept it, but others certainly would not. After lunch, we went for a tour of the excavations, and Lorin again distinguished himself with an inspired guess. A series of large, regular, cell-like rooms had been uncovered by Peter's team in the angle formed by the cliff and the enclosure wall. They were joined by a long corridor, and there was evidence of paved floors and a system of drainage. Each room was approximately 25 feet square, and it seems that these were the only buildings outside the enclosure which had been made of stone blocks and not adobe clay. The closest we could come to a purpose for these cells was to call them the prison. Do I have to do all the work around here? Lorin sighed. When you've just shown me pictures of the war elephants? Elephant stables, I said. Very quick, lad. Lorin clapped me on the shoulder, and I blushed. But I believe they're called elephant lines in India. After dinner, I worked for an hour in my darkroom, developing three rolls of film. And when I was finished, I went to look for Lorin. He was leaving again early the following morning, and there was much for us to discuss. He wasn't in the guest room, nor in the lounge. But when I asked for him, Raoul told me, I think he's gone up to the cavern, Doctor. He borrowed a torch from me. Leslie looked at him in a way which clearly was meant to be highly significant, a frown and a quick little shake of the head, but it meant as much to him as it did to me. I went to fetch my own torch and set off through the silent grove, picking my way carefully around the open excavations. No light showed from the entrance of the tunnel beyond the great wild fig tree. Lorin, I called. Lorin, are you there? And my voice bounced hollowly from cliff and rock. There was silence once the echoes died, and I went forward into the tunnel. Flashing my torch into the darkness ahead, ducking my head under the zooming flight of the bats, and hearing my own footsteps magnified in the silence, I could see no light. And I called again. Lorin! My voice boomed around the cavern. There was no reply, and I went on down the passage. As I stepped out from the mouth of the tunnel, suddenly the beam of a powerful torch flashed from across the cavern, shining full in my eyes. Lorin, I asked. That you? What do you want, Ben? He demanded from the darkness behind the torch. He sounded irritable, almost angry. I want to talk to you about the plans for the next step, I shielded my eyes from the beam. It can wait till tomorrow. Yes, but you're leaving early. Let's talk now. I started to cross the cavern towards him, averting my eyes from the dazzling beam. Point that light somewhere else, won't you? I protested mildly. Are you deaf? And Lorin's voice rasped, the voice of a man used to being obeyed. I said tomorrow, damn you. I stopped dead, stunned and confused. He had never spoken to me like that in my life before. Lo, are you all right? I asked anxiously. There was something wrong here in the cavern. I could sense it. Ben, his voice crackled. Just turn around and walk out of here, will you? I'll see you tomorrow morning. I hesitated a moment longer, and then I turned and walked back down the passage. I hadn't even had a glimpse of Lorin in the darkness beyond the torch.